The Football Pod with Paddy and Andy.
I remember having the argument with Jack beforehand, kind of going, Jack, if this shit doesn't work, you better put me back out in the field and don't whip the big donkey out of full power.
Download the OTB Sports app and subscribe to the GAA podcast feed now.
OTB AM
with Gillette, proud supporters of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow.
All right, let's mow indeed. 7:30 this Tuesday morning. It's time for us to see what football looks like in the new middle interim assistant to the potential interim manager era at Manchester United. Because tonight, they're at Villarreal to face Unai Emery and see what they can do. Now, shorn of their manager and the shield that he has provided to the players in recent weeks, how will the players respond? Will they put in their best performance of the season? They may well do so. We'll find out tonight. It's an early kickoff, just to mark your cards. Isn't that right? It's a 5:30?
Yeah. 5:45, I think, isn't it?
Right. So, I just realised it's going to cause a little bit of friction in many houses. It's around the time when, you know, got to get a bit of homework and get a bit of dinner done. But no, it's work. You have to watch this. You're going to have to sit there like a Man United fan and dutifully say, this is work for us tonight. So if you're a Manchester United fan, let's be having you. How are you feeling about everything? The Pochettino rumours, they're just sucking you in to the point where you're like, yes, we're going to get Pochettino. It's not going to be Brian Robson for the next 6 months or Gaza. That's the level we're at the moment, isn't it?
Mm.
A Brian Robson Gaza dream team.
That would certainly be. They may as well feed the beast at the moment that is consuming Manchester United content rather than just going with boring Michael Carrick at this point. Give him Roy Keane, give him whoever, give him Mark Hughes. I'm reading this morning in the Mail as a potential option. Yeah. If they're looking for options,
we were floating that yesterday. I made the point, I don't know how to make it on air or off air, like if the marketing team are doing the analysis of everything that Roy Keane does when he generates content, then they're saying, look, don't know how it's going to go from a football perspective, from a financial perspective, we're going to make a lot of money by putting Roy Keane in here.
Mm.
The whole world is going to tune in every day. It is a real life Truman Show and we're going to make a lot of money. Joel, I know you might not like this guy. He might not like you. Or else you guys are actually going to hit it off straight away.
Yeah.
And it's going to make a lot of money for us. We will suddenly start filming everything and we will have an Amazon documentary series ready to go the day after he leaves. We'll have a constant team editing nonstop. And everybody will watch every single second.
Mm. Wasn't there a situation where on Celebrity Big Brother they put in the formerly divorced couple into the house together? That would be the equivalent of Roy Keane and Harry Maguire going in together in this Amazon.
And did they know in advance how they agreed?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they had.
Right.
Your man from The Ordinary Boys, what was his name, Spencer something, he had actually met her on Celebrity Big Brother and then years later they did a reunion show
right.
where they threw them back in and they got divorced. I think that's how it went. I could be completely making that up, but
it's a fantastic idea.
So if that can work, then Maguire and Roy Keane, the same documentary, could certainly work. Because that is the dominant thing here. Forget about the results. Forget about what this actually used to be. A football club, by the way, is what it used to be. This is all about feeding that beast and giving us what we want. Because I guess that's all important right now for Manchester United.
What's the new news this morning? What's happening? Michael Carrick says him and Ole were simpatico and the team will play the same. They're going to do the same. They've just done that, got the manager sacked. Is that how you would address your... If you were advising Michael Carrick on his first day of press, it's like, oh, I love Ollie, but we obviously need to change things up a little bit, you know? The results haven't been good enough and that's why the manager's left and that's why I'm here.
Mm.
And so we've got to very quickly try and turn our season around.
Yeah, that's what you should advise.
You're not distancing yourself too much from him, but you're distancing yourself just enough to say, I understand he got fired because the results are bad. Instead, look, you know, it's always difficult in the press conference. Maybe he did say all that, but he's also like, oh, it's going to be the same. You know, we got on very well. That's why things worked so well for a while.
Yeah.
They worked so well, he got fired.
You do have to admire the dedication to the bit, which is everybody worships at the altar of Ole and it doesn't even matter if he's not the manager anymore. That Carrick coming out and saying, yeah, we're very similar, we'll play in a very similar way. It's clearly not a hopeful note, I'd imagine, for a lot of Manchester United fans. But it certainly shows a lot of dedication to that bit. Like Harry Maguire, again, coming out yesterday and saying that, you know, we let the manager down, we got him sacked. I would suspect that if things suddenly turn around for Manchester United over the next little while, Solskjaer would actually get a lot of credit. Like, you know, the way people laughed at pundits in England last year for saying, you know, Frank's got to take a lot of credit for the groundwork he laid at Chelsea. That Champions League trophy is his as much as Tommy Tuchel's. This will be the same situation this year with Solskjaer. Should they do anything, it's like you got to admire the groundwork he laid for this great explosion of success.
I've worked closely with Ollie for a long time. We have very similar beliefs. We did as players and we certainly do as coaches. Of course, I've got my own personality compared to Ollie, but of course, our style is very similar. That's why we worked together for so long and it went so well for a period of time. It did work so well for a period of time. Would you have said that there was a lot of personality about Michael Carrick? That would have been one of the things that I would have said. He doesn't really have... there was never his personality in the team.
No, he was a perfectly vanilla sort of midfielder who was very, very good.
I think... I've always maintained I think Michael Carrick was overrated by all the Man United fans, always, and to this day. I thought he was overrated then. I still think he's overrated now. I think he was surrounded by some of the best players in world football at the absolute peak of their powers.
Yeah.
And so he was a water carrier for the rest of the team.
But that, I think, but water carry for the rest of the team is the key point there. That I think you.
But I think a lot of other people could have done that too.
Maybe. I think that can be sometimes underplayed. I mean, you look at their current water carriers, they can't really carry water.
Well, if they were carrying water for peak Ronaldo, peak Rooney, peak Van Nistelrooy, I think those water carriers in midfield would be totally fine.
Fair point, I guess. But
if they had Evra and Vidic and Ferdinand, would Fred and McTominay suddenly look so bad?
Maybe not. I would still think that we maybe concede the wood from the trees to a point here, and that Carrick would be an upgrade. Carrick would be an upgrade on McTominay or Fred.
Carrick might be an extra 2 or 3% on those players, but is he like Xavi? Oh, he's the English Xavi. He is not the English Xavi. He is not the English Iniesta.
Well, but
he is not in that conversation. That, well, the Man United fans at the time, then and now, in retrospect, say, "Oh, Carrick, what a player! Oh, Jesus, he was so great."
I just think he was very, very good at being
Carrick,
doing the very basic things, which was
good
so
as
required.
Late stage Scholes, even.
So would you throw Darren Fletcher into that same conversation as Michael Carrick?
Yeah, two grand players.
Yeah.
Two grand players who were surrounded by much better. So John O'Shea, like John O'Shea obviously benefited from playing alongside really, really world-class players and had a brilliant career. Like, they had brilliant careers, but I don't think Michael Carrick... When did Carrick dominate a tournament? When was he the best player at a tournament? When did
Lampard or Gerrard do that? Like, I mean, Carrick, if you're going to talk tournaments, I mean, the fact that he is English probably diminishes his ability to dominate a tournament. There's a wider problem there. I just think the ability to be grand is underappreciated in that Manchester United team because they achieved so many great things.
No. Owen, if I put you in the team with Evra and Vidic and Ferdinand and whatever, was it mostly Gary Neville would have played with him? And then you've also got... like someone else in midfield to do a fair bit of running for you, and you've got Rooney and Ronaldo or Tevez and Van Nistelrooy or whoever it was, Luis Saha, like whatever collection of players are around you, your job is just to pass it sideways.
Yeah. I'm not saying it was common.
I think he could have done it.
He was clearly like...
He was good at it. He was very good at that.
He would struggle to make the best 9 players on that starting 11 for sure on any given week.
The best 13 players on that starting 11.
On this spot.
But the Man United fans will tell you that, he's a genius. Saw the game. He's a chess master. Gary Kasparov. It's like, okay, fair enough, whatever. Take it outside, do it in private, whatever you want.
I guess we'll see now. I mean, if you're bringing a Kasparov level of innovation to the game, you're probably going to be able to implement it from the sideline as much as from pulling the strings in midfield. So you could be eating humble pie in a couple of weeks.
Maybe
prove him as a great midfield maestro, basically, is what you're saying.
Maybe he's got a brilliant football brain. Maybe they were right and I'm wrong, you know?
I'm eagerly awaiting the moment
the tempting bit that's making all the Man United fans suddenly feel like maybe this isn't a complete shit show is the fact that the rumours growing that Pochettino might ditch Paris Saint-Germain in the middle of the season because he's had that big row with Leonardo. Now, he seems to have had a row with Leonardo very early on in the whole process, and there was some talk Leonardo might be on his way out 3 or 4 months ago, but that didn't happen. And they do have the greatest collection of talent in the attacking third of the field that anybody's ever assembled. They hasn't quite morphed into a team just yet, but they still have loads of great players, and they're still in the Champions League, and they're still obviously probably going to win the league. So it's not a terrible job that Pochettino has, but maybe Pochettino is putting this out there to win the power battle at Paris Saint-Germain. That's one potential. Maybe he's putting it out there to, because it's true, maybe he's about to leave to come to Man United in the middle of the season, because he knows that the Man United job is a 3.5 year job. Everybody gets it for a lot longer than they deserve, and he probably deserves to get it for a long time. So it's like, will I stay at Paris Saint-Germain, where I will get sacked at some point in the next 12 months unless I win the Champions League? And even then, if I win the Champions League, I'll get sacked the next season for not winning the Champions League. And what's my next job going to be? I'm now at the point where I can manage the super clubs. Which of the Spanish super clubs are going to be available to me? Not a whole heap. There's a limited list because of my my past playing. I mean, that's stupid, but it seems to be a thing. Maybe the Madrid job isn't something he wants right now, because he looks at the playing staff there, although they played pretty well at the weekend. Good to see how they get on in the Champions League over the next couple of weeks. So I don't know, the Man United job right now, yeah, I'll take it.
Yeah,
do it.
Yeah, like, say if it doesn't go overly well, like, you are leaving yourself open to the criticism, not only of it not going well at Manchester United, but the fact that you walked out on Paris Saint-Germain. Now, I accept if it's a situation where he gets sacked and he becomes a free agent, essentially, and goes to Manchester United, that there is definitely a part, I'm sure, of him thinking, the optics of him walking out on this project wouldn't be great. I mean, like, where's your ambition as a manager? If you're managing Lionel Messi and you walk out on that project, granted, Ligue 1 is Ligue 1.
Well, if you walk out on it for a crap job, grand. But if you walk out of it for Manchester United in crisis, your ambition is pretty high. Your ego is massive to the point where you're like, yeah, I can fix what Mourinho couldn't, what Solskjaer, club legend with like the most backing of any team in the history of football, what Van Gaal, one of the fathers of modern football, and, well, David Moyes is okay, you know, but, well, I'm going to beat all those and I'm going to win something for this team. And the next manager who wins the league for Manchester United has a job for 10 years. Like, pretty much. You're going to stay there for 10 years, and you can also start getting paid like the crazy money that Atletico Madrid pay.
Yeah, well, Pochettino is not going to be a Manchester United manager for 10 years. I think
if he wins a league title in the next 3 seasons, I guarantee he doesn't leave before 10 years, because it's like, who else are you going to get, lads? Nobody.
Well, another manager will come along. I think Pochettino and Conte, you could make a case that they burn brightly for a while, and they're extremely intense. And
you'd have said the same about Klopp, and here we are 6 years in.
Fair, yeah. That you could definitely have said that about him. But I think this is on a whole other level. I think that they burned so brightly with Spurs under Mauricio Pochettino, and things went south so quickly. It was actually incredible how it happened. Conte maybe to a lesser extent, and maybe there's a sense of them just kind of moving on to the next project. Does he even want a 10-year gig?
Somebody had suggested Diego Simeone yesterday, and I went to look at Simeone's. We were talking about great players who become great managers, and I was looking back to see what his managerial record was before he got to Atletico. Do you know this?
Because
I didn't know it, right? So pretty much from stopping playing, he went to Racing Club in Argentina for 4 months, from February 2006 to May 2006. He went to Estudiantes for 14 months, from May to December. Went to River Plate for 9 months. Went to San Lorenzo for a year. Went to Catania in Sicily, first time managing out of Argentina, for 6 months to save them from relegation. Went back to Racing for 2 years, and then went to Atletico and has been there 10 years next month. So bounce, 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 like real kind of, I've got no attention span, and then this job's for me, job for life.
Yeah, like, I guess there is that sense that managers are always looking to couple up with somebody that they want to stay with forever, and they eventually find it and they want to do that. It helps that Simeone is the best paid manager in the world, and that kind of is a little bit of an incentive for him to stay for a bit longer. But I take your point. That is that is a good case study in someone who can go from this sort of bounce around to a really dedicated manager and something that always feels fresh. Like in the situation of Klopp, for example, at no point did that ever feel stale throughout his entire... How many years is Klopp in charge of Liverpool now at this point? 7 years at this stage? Like at no point has it ever felt like it's gone stale, because winning is this really exciting thing, and then you stop winning for one or two seasons, then you win again, and there is kind of a state of flux once you get your first couple of trophies. It's until you get there that really things can start to feel like they're going stale. So maybe, as you say, if Pochettino does somehow win a Premier League title with Manchester United in the next two or three seasons, that is the thing that kickstarts solidity and will kickstart a long period of time.
It'll be hard to leave if you turn that into a successful club. It'll be very hard to leave, because there are no other jobs really in world football that are as interesting and as exciting, and like it's right up there. That's why they should be able to get the best managers. It's mad that they've got like a catalogue of mediocrity and busted flushes to take this job in the post-Ferguson era. The amount of money that's sloshing around that is available to the next manager is huge. Get the best one. If Pochettino's head is being turned, you get on the plane, you bring him a Fabergé egg, you do whatever it takes, and you kidnap him. It's extraordinary rendition. You pay the money to PSG, who, like, you know... Or you just get him to say it. I want the Man United job, and then PSG have to fire him.
Yeah.
Oh, that Man United job is the best job in world football. It's the Manchester United of jobs.
Well,
that's what
go.
He could say.
There you go, yeah.
It's the Man United of jobs.
Every manager wants to manage Manchester United. And, he could potentially pull a few strings, but, I'm not.
First time ever that Kildare fans would know how the Paris Saint-Germain fans feel.
My concern, like for this, if you're actually predicting this is going to happen, is not so much on him wanting to be Manchester United manager. It is him wanting to continue with Paris Saint-Germain. I just don't see the truly compelling reason for him to leave this project. The fact that it's been challenging, I would say, is something that would keep someone like Mauricio Pochettino in the job and see this thing out. Like, I mean, you're going to quit. You're going to quit on Lionel Messi mid-season.
Yeah, because there's a possibility Messi quits. There's like a vague, non-zero chance that Messi forces his way out at Christmas to go back and join.
Well, if that's the reality, if you're Pochettino and you think that's going to happen, then of course that can push you out of the club. But under the assumption,
who's in charge? And Mbappe wants to leave. It's a shit show at Paris Saint Germain. It's obviously a shit show at Man United, but it'd be his shit show. He would be the boss.
Well, but it kind of is at PSG as well. So they're going to win Ligue 1 this season, and it's like, look at the shit show, and I won a trophy.
Yeah.
In this absolute calamity.
In fairness, that the absence of a trophy on a CV seems to be something that, like.
That's it. You can tick that box this season. Manchester United will get him for whatever.
I'm sorry, but winning the League Cup does not count. You know, like Mourinho, Zlatan's counting the League Cup as, oh, won two trophies. Now, he did win the Europa League.
Mm. But is there a chance that United just wait? Is there a chance that, you know, it's going to cost him 10 million quid to get Pochettino now? It'll cost him 5 million quid at the end of the season.
Well, the amount you
get your season, Poch.
You get your season, but then we might
or
not
do
qualify
get your trophy,
for the Champions
rather.
League. What if we don't qualify for the Champions League? Then Poch's like, I'm not coming now. He didn't know look your side of the bargain.
Well, no. Like, I mean, if they don't qualify for the Champions League, then Poch can come in and he's taking a club from an even lower base, and he's like, I got you back into the Champions League, and it's a win-win. You've also then potentially got a situation where at the end of the season, maybe Ronaldo leaves Manchester United. And
perfect.
Of course, Mauricio Pochettino has already said that Messi is the best player in the world this season. He says there's no question. He said it's difficult to change your view on whether Messi or Ronaldo is better, but Messi is the best in the world.
Before I worked with him, I didn't realise just how amazing he was, the impact he has on the young kids at training. You should see how Marcus Rashford looks up to him. This will change Rashford's life forever.
Like,
easily done.
It would be funny if Pochettino showed up at Old Trafford and was like, you know what, after working with Lionel Messi, he's kind of crap, you know. He's a bad trainer, terrible human being. He's a shame on Argentina.
We need a sideline advising these managers what to say in their press utterances. It's 7:48. I'm going to tell you what's coming up between now and 10 o'clock. We'll come back to this, obviously, because the comments are rolling in. Look, let's not get sidetracked on Michael Carrick, right? I don't think he's great. You guys all think he's great. That's up to you. Your choice. You pay your money. Louise Galvin's going to join us at 8:05 to talk rugby. We've got sports pages at 8:25. We've got sports news at 8:45. Owen Murphy, Kilkenny Hurler at 8:50. Graham Hunter at 9:10 to knock a bit of sense into us. And then Monday Night Rugby at 9:30. OTBAM with Gillette, proud sponsors of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow. I can't believe you clowns on Friday are still rating me 3 out of 3.
I got dumped for Adrian. I think it's like an ironic rankings.
That's it. I agree. Shifty Lad says, couldn't agree more with Jer about Carrick sideways and back. Very overrated, but Jesus, don't say that around these Sky pundits. Z says, I've got to agree with you on Carrick. He was well overrated as a player. Mark says, Carrick falls into the Dunphy quote of, he is, was a good player, not a great player. I would agree. He's a good player, not a great player. Jack Reaper says, disagree on Carrick point. You don't keep your place in that United players only being able to pass sideways and backwards. Very underrated, Carrick. He is not underrated. He is like one of the most highly rated midfielders of his generation, despite the fact that they were actually world-class midfielders in his generation. Paul says, when did United fans say he was a genius? Can we at least start the argument at a half-truth? Who have they had in midfield that was better since? Anyone who's played with him said he was excellent.
See, I kind of agree with Paul there to a point. I don't think anybody did profess him to be a genius. I think there's just this great adoration because he's like one of us.
My point is,
he is mediocre,
he is
like
so
all of us.
Underrated that he is like one of the most overrated footballers. It's like, oh, this guy, nobody appreciates his excellence. Mm. Excellence. Like, yeah, okay. He was like a middle of the road passer, good engine, some game smarts, but like grand. He was grand. That's the point. Anyway, let's not get Carrick the player will have no impact on Carrick the manager. That's the point about this Steven Gerrard. Like, what's the latest thing Steven Gerrard has done? What do you think he's done? He's got to the training ground. What is he banned on?
Yeah, he has banned ketchup. Which
mayonnaise.
Oh, he's banned mayonnaise as
and
well.
And ketchup. Yeah. Like fizzy drinks. Because it's a high performance, high aspiration. They turned Rangers around and they're going to do the same thing here.
Do you think there's like a black market for ketchup sachets at the moment that we could possibly get into? Nice little learner there on the side, meeting footballers around the back of the training lot, selling them little sachets. And like, I don't know. Gerrard genius is basically what you're saying.
Well, what happens
after one game?
What happens is, and John Giles is always aware of this, is a new manager comes in and criticises the old regime subtly enough. It's like, oh, they didn't do this that I'm going to do. The team aren't fit enough. The medical staff wasn't good enough, whatever it is. And that's not what Gerrard's doing here. It's more subtle. It's, the dietitians, they weren't on it. They just didn't have that elite mindset that I have as a serial winner, who, of course, didn't actually win a league title.
I'm all for that. Like, I'm sure Xavi has replaced the ketchup at Barcelona as well, but he's gone that one step further and was like, too many injuries at his club. Medical staff, you're all fired, and he brings over his entire medical team from Al Sadd.
Did he?
Which, I was just reading that this morning, which is quite the step. I mean, that is how you lay down a marker. That's how you sort of, if there's actual success in the near future for Barcelona, I think that's something you could point to and say, well, that was a pretty seismic change, rather than, you know, I was going to say Arsene Wenger small changes, but actually didn't he give his players like vitamin tablets and all that sort of stuff for whatever they were. To completely overhaul the future of the club.
And it totally worked. Tonight, Villarreal against Manchester United, 5:45. Young Boys against Atalanta at 8 o'clock in that group. Chelsea against Juventus at 8 o'clock. Malmo against Zenit, also at 8 o'clock in that group as well. I think things are pretty straightforward for Chelsea at this point. Roman Abramovich is back in England after a long period of time where he wasn't travelling to England, but he's not going to the game tonight. He's got a bit of a do on instead. So people ask him, what would the Keane thing look like? Could Keane manage Manchester United between now and the end of the season? Is it possible? What would it look like? How would it manifest itself? What would Harry Maguire's agent be, or sources close to Harry Maguire, what would they be leaking to the papers when it was announced? Because there's not going to be a 2 or 3 day warm up to this. It's just going to be like, bang, Keane's going to arrive in one day and go, I'm back.
First game, they get smashed. Harry Maguire goes to Twitter to apologise, and he's like, I'm sorry for absolutely nothing. I'm sorry because our manager's shite. I'm sorry, our manager's pathetic. He's got absolutely no experience. Where the hell has he managed? And just proceeds to kick him until he's down after coming on for 2 minutes in a 2-0 defeat to Newcastle at Old Trafford. That's the sort of future we have. Like, I mean, it's a very, very entertaining fantasy to think about, Roy Keane at Manchester United right now. If you were writing Dream Team, this is the sort of narrative you would write. You would indulge yourself to the point where it's ridiculous and would be entertaining, and everybody would be tuning in for the next episode. What do you think? Like, it's just so beyond the idea of being reasonable, this idea of Roy Keane there, that you can't allow yourself to think about it too long.
Was Gary Neville's time at Valencia so shit that he can't get it? Yeah. Is it? Was it?
Maybe Manchester United are so unaware of what that would do to maybe the image of the club, that there is this, like, I don't think Solskjaer necessarily, his legacy will be overly negative as the years go by, but definitely it feels that there was this pally nature to the analysis of Solskjaer and how Solskjaer got in, this attachment to nostalgia, this connection to the past that I guess paved the way for Solskjaer to come back in. Any of those two names that you mentioned, any of the Sky lads going in, is like that is just that times 10. At least Solskjaer had some degree of managerial experience that wasn't a complete catastrophe behind him. Now, in fairness, Keane does have that as well, but it was ages ago. I can't believe we're even talking about the possibility of either of those two names being in the mix for Manchester United job. It's just absolutely beyond reason to think that they're not
in the mix. The whole point is they're absolutely not in the mix for the job, right? Because you need if Pochettino agrees to come but says I want to see at the end of the season, which is a most likely outcome here, is that actually they do a backdoor deal with somebody like Pochettino. It becomes an open secret that he's the new manager, but Manchester United appoint an interim manager in the meantime. At that stage, you'd have to say the most likely outcome is that Carrick gets it until the end of the year, or they put Fletcher in instead because Carrick...
they got them mixed up.
Whatever. You know, it's possible that like they're like, oh, we said that we were going to get an interim, you're going to be the interim, and we want to give you this experience over the next while, and we feel like Carrick is too closely associated with Solskjaer, and actually, we just got beaten by Villarreal. So a lot hinges on tonight's game, but the most likely outcome is that they do a deal with Pochettino and Pochettino agrees to come at the end of the season, for the point of you're talking about the dilettante nature of it, and actually it would cost too much money, whereas in the summer they probably think they can do a deal for nothing. And maybe Zidane is lined up already at that point to take over PSG for whatever. So you can see how the end of the season is better for everybody. In that scenario, you get an interim manager, where they decide they don't want Fletcher tainted by what happens. They want somebody to come in and make sure that the players don't slack off. The list of candidates is Steve Bruce. This is like Hollywood Squares. It's Steve Bruce. Arsene Wenger came up yesterday. I was suggesting, could Ferguson do it for like 6 months? Could he do it for 6 months? He probably could. You can't give it to Giggsy anymore. He's off the register.
You can invite him to a corporate box.
I mean, it's not a great look, but they're still doing it. You've got Mark Hughes. And what's behind door number six?
Oh no! How are Manchester United in this position?
Because they don't have any. They don't have a well-oiled football department. In fairness, getting Darren Fletcher in at this age means that in 15, 20 years' time, they're going to have like a slew of people who are involved in football and who know football. And by all accounts, Fletcher is an absolute, like, he is genuinely supposed to be a football genius. So, I think that there's room and opportunity there for that football department to grow. But they needed to do that 20 years ago and they didn't, right? Because they had the monoculture where it was ruled by a dictator, and they've tried to replicate that afterwards, and none of the dictators who came afterwards were anywhere near as good as Alex Ferguson. Funnily enough, it turned out he was one of a kind. So, in that scenario, it's not completely ridiculous to think that you could put any of these people in. I would say the safest pair of hands is Hughes, but his football management, not great.
And I appreciate that you caveated that by saying in this scenario it's not totally unreasonable, but let's just remove that scenario. In reality, that is a ridiculous situation that generated from themselves.
The alternative was to keep Solskjaer until the end of the season and then get Pochettino.
It's like saying in this scenario where time travel is possible, it's not ridiculous that we end up in the year 1971. Of course, the conditions you've created in that hypothetical are bonkers.
No, it's the opposite of that.
That Roy Keane is a possibility.
This is exactly what they did. This is how badly Man United has been managed. They didn't create a time machine.
I accept the scenario, but
this is actually a real scenario.
What I would say is closer to the truth is another scenario they've created, which was just handing out these contracts last month to the likes of Kieran McKenna, Mike Phelan. Like that was bad business, and they're now going to have to be either paid off or given a new role.
It wasn't bad business because what a month ago they thought that they were sticking with Solskjaer. So if they didn't give them those contracts at that point, Solskjaer would have realised, oh, you're firing me. But like then the results might have been bad. It's so badly managed. The football side of the club is so badly managed that scenario that I've outlined to you, it's the alternatives are get Pochettino now.
Yep.
Get Brendan Rodgers now, or appoint an interim manager. And your interim managers are Fletcher, it's Michael Carrick, or it's one of that collection of people who will do the job for 6 months knowing they can't get the job.
Mm-hmm.
And who can do that? For Roy Keane, it would be perfect. For his career and his life.
Of course it would. It would be perfect for Roy Keane, of course it would.
It would be like, absolutely, it would be dream scenario. You get to go in, he would like get to physically manhandle some of those players, and the content would be unbelievable. So whatever the money they lose from not qualifying for the Champions League, they make back in content and revenue from advertising and sponsorship.
It's the Roy Keane and Harry Maguire roadshow, sponsored by Gazprom. That is how they make their money next year, and I'm here for it.
Zlatan's in the papers. We were supposed to do this later on, but it feels perfect to do it now. Zlatan's been interviewed by Donald McRae. Donald McRae interviews are always excellent, so you got to read this. It's in the Guardian today. You'll get it free online. Considering the ongoing travails of United, who remain enthralled to the Ferguson years, Zlatan says, "They talk too much about the past. When I went there, I said, I'm here to focus on the present and to make my own story. But when you have too much, it becomes like a loop. You have to think about the present, or you should go to a hospital and clean your head." Manchester United. Who would be the hospital? Roy Keane is the hospital in this scenario. Is the loop not Michael Carrick? Is Michael Carrick not just Groundhog Day? Zlatan has it. He knows the truth. They talk too much about the past. Now, Roy Keane's obviously the past, but he's also, in this instance, a hospital.
All I can see is, like, you know that scene in The Dark Knight when your man, the Two-Face, who's about to become Two-Face, is sitting in the bed, and there's a nurse, and the nurse turns around to slowly reveal himself to be Joker. It's Harry Maguire sitting in the bed, and his PPE is Roy Keane slowly turning around, and it's a very, very grim realisation that his career is over.
Or rescued. You know,
yeah.
Roy
Keane blows up the hospital on his way out. It's exactly how it goes. And you know what? It will be dramatic, as you say.
What if Roy Keane's message only works with good quality players? Man United, we all keep saying they've got good quality players. That squad's too good to blah 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 blah. Be good to see it, but like maybe they respond to him in a way that Ipswich couldn't.
Look, I mean, Roy Keane will only ever work again as manager in a short, sharp burst, probably. This will be a short, sharp burst at the end of the season. I'm going to entertain you here. Let's go along with this. Then, you know what? It's a great idea. Like, from a neutral standpoint, from a media standpoint, it's an absolutely fantastic idea.
From a neutral standpoint, therefore, it's also a fantastic idea.
Exactly. From a Manchester United, the only ones who stand to lose from Manchester United appointing Roy Keane as manager are Manchester United. So,
do they stand to lose that much? Could he be any worse than Carrick? I don't think so. Carrick says he thinks he's got a slightly different personality from Solskjaer. I'm not sure we've seen it. I'd say they seem very, very similar in terms of temperament. They both seem like lovely men.
What you want from a new manager is will there be an urge within the dressing room to try and impress this new guy? Are you going to get that from Michael Carrick over the next little while? Probably not. Then again, maybe he's just a better manager than Solskjaer. That's another thing that we don't know, and maybe that will actually be the reason why
it's unlikely he could be any worse. Solskjaer was like the very minimum level. Daniel Harris said Neil Warnock couldn't do any worse than the situation at the moment. I mean, and that's true. It feels that way.
I didn't listen to yesterday's show, and it just seems that I missed the greatest list of candidates produced of all time. Really wish I was in yesterday.
King Arthur USA says Poch will never win United. He was a failure with Spurs, and Leicester won the league that season when Spurs blew up. Give it to Rooney. So we did talk about Rooney as well. Rooney did a great post-match interview after they'd just beaten Bournemouth to get to 0 points, having been deducted 18. And he in fairness had done his media training. His practice line was, I'm going to be at Derby. We've got a really, great bunch of players, really fought today, and I'm going to be here until I'm told otherwise. And then immediately afterwards, Sky cut to Wayne Rooney would find it very difficult, a reporter saying, Wayne Rooney would find it very difficult to turn down the interim Man United job if they offered it to him.
Yeah.
So obviously someone within the camp was like, amazing juxtaposition. Mm-hmm. And of course Wayne Rooney, because it would be like getting him out of jail at Derby. He was I did a great job at Derby, got back to 0 points. Mm-hmm. And then I got this job for 6 months, and then I retired. I realised I'm a good pundit. I'm going to have the crack being a pundit, or maybe I'll be a coach, I don't know. Right, Carrick was actually a very polarising player, says Connor, among the fan base for years, and only really became appreciated around 2011-2012 when his song took off. Nobody ever said he was on Xavi or Iniesta's level. Fergus says Carrick like Deschamps wasn't brilliant but necessary. I mean, you definitely need a midfielder who's going to get the ball off the defence and pass it back to the defence. Paul says get Cantona in. Let's just throw this season to entertainment if they're hiring someone next season anyway. David May is assistant manager. Get it done, Ed, says Paul. David May's hanging around, all right. Does a Man United podcast, so he'd be available. Right, we haven't even got to Arsenal. We'll get to Arsenal a little bit later on. OTBAM with Gillette, proud sponsors of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow. Back in a sec.
OTB AM.
Right, 8:05 this morning here on OTBAM. Your comments are coming in thick and fast. There's a lot of love for Michael Carrick, the player. And that's fair enough. You're a Man United fan. He was there on loads of great days. That's the crack.
Are you sure you're not like misremembering Michael Carrick and the attitude towards him as some sort of borderline ironic, as in like Iniesta?
No. I definitely had long, boring arguments with Man United fans at the time about how there were some, not many, who would have said that he was the perfect combination of Keane and Scholes, in that he had Keane's energy and he had Scholes' passing, and so therefore, it was a small minority, and I don't want to indulge those people too much. But I had those conversations, and they're constantly like, I remember one guy texted me 4.5 years after we'd last had a conversation after Carrick got man of the match, and some, like, they probably beat West Ham 4-0 or something, and the text was, still think Carrick's shit. That was it. Hadn't had any conversation with this person in 4.5 years, but he waited until then, until he was a man of the match in one game. I was like, ah, I got you now.
Yeah, I actually need to go back to a few people who got on to me over the course of the summer for a couple of Solskjaer takes last season. Somebody got into me over the course of the summer being like, you said last year Hasenhüttl is an unquestionably better manager than Solskjaer. Where are you at now with that take? I should get back to him actually and be like, who's still in the job, mate?
I mean, I actually...
When he did beat Hasenhüttl 9-0, let's not forget, but I'm going to forget about that.
You would have seen Hasenhüttl linked with the job at various places as well. I mean, look, we'll see. 7:08 this morning. If you want to get in touch, 087-9180-180 is the WhatsApp number. Wherever you're watching the world, we'd love to hear from you. You can get us on YouTube. The best place to listen to us these days is, of course, the OTB Sports app. You can listen to us just as a radio show. We've got a live, continuous feed of top quality sports content all day on OTB Sports Radio. All you got to do is tell your smart speaker to play OTB Sports Radio and you should be okay. If you want to get in touch with us, of course, we'd love to hear from you. Now, time for us to turn our attention back to rugby. I'm delighted to say Louise Galvin is back with us. Louise, how are you getting on?
Good, and yourselves?
Yeah, pretty good. We're trying to temper our levels of excitement to find reasons not to be too excited after, well, really quite a swashbuckling trio of games where we never looked in any danger of losing any of the matches. We were clearly the better side in the three games. We've got strength and depth, and it's all pretty rosy. So what should we do here, Louise? Should we get carried away?
No, absolutely not. Don't get carried away. It's a job well done. It's definitely an affirmation of all those things that you've just said. We can play with different styles, I think, to win games, which is another point to add in there, because we played against Japan versus Argentina was quite different in terms of how they defended, I suppose, and how we broke them down. But definitely the idea of having a little bit more strength and depth, to have, you know, such young players coming in. And I think the main word I have for them is dynamism. They're just so dynamic. Like from the last day, obviously, the likes of Ryan Baird coming in, Dan Sheehan, I thought they were phenomenal and really took their opportunity. And it's like this new breed of rugby player that's coming up in terms of their position and their conditioning and their kind of mindset of, I'm not just going to run over the top of someone. They all have, you know, great hands and that ability to find a soft shoulder, low center of gravity, take a step. And, you know, the work rate there is phenomenal as well. And then when you hear kind of slightly older members of the group, the more experienced members of the group, like Peter Mann using the word fun in press conferences, you're like, whoa, we're onto something good here. But then we got to, you know, settle ourselves, because I think for all Northern Hemisphere sides, it's a case of keeping in mind that the Southern Hemisphere sides are jaded, worse than they ever are coming over November. The effect of COVID on their tours has been massive. And I think Ledesma really touched on that as well in terms of the Argentinian side, the fact none of them even play their club rugby in their own continent. So we have to kind of take that into account as well. So all in all, we've done what we needed to do, but it's still, what are we, 2 years out from a World Cup. Its position aren't at their peak, like maybe the Northern Hemisphere sides are coming into the start of the season. So we're in good stead, but nothing to get too carried away with yet.
And I think especially on that front is the way and the shape in which the Southern Hemisphere teams came up to the Northern Hemisphere, that I think there is maybe in the aftermath of the All Blacks game a bit of a caution because of what happened in 2018. But as you say, it's not even the 1 year out from the World Cup scenario from the last cycle, it's the 2 years out from the World Cup scenario, because 2017 Ireland played South Africa and smashed them. I think at halftime Brent Pope was saying this is the worst performance Ireland have ever come up against, or maybe didn't say that, but it was something quite heavy and quite on that level. And 2 years later, obviously they're World Cup champions, so that is the level that they can turn to, as much as we need to temper our own expectations.
Yeah, and it'll be a warning sign to them as well about how strong the Northern Hemisphere teams are. And it is across the board. That's one thing from the Six Nations, we're not the only form team. Like France are, oh my goodness, that game was phenomenal on Saturday night. Like Wales would be, they're right off that first game. They obviously didn't have a lot of their internationals available for the first game against New Zealand. But even just to grind out that tight win, similarly with England, Eddie Jones would be delighted. So, you know, teams are, the North Hemisphere teams, they're all doing pretty well. But we can't all do well and be happy come the end of Six Nations either. But I suppose it's a good starting point. And I think what I like is it wasn't that, you know, we scored a load of tries against Japan and we scored a load of tries against a jaded Argentinian side, but we just resorted to kicking a few penalties and grinding out a win against New Zealand. It's how we won the games, and it's also who we had playing, that we didn't. We had a relatively settled team, certainly in the pack, but we weren't relying on, okay, Johnny has to stay in the field. Now, if Joey didn't have such a good performance the last day, that might still be a big, I suppose, asterisk beside it, and it probably still is a little bit. I'm not sure if Ryburn really is third in line there, whether it was just more exposure to the whole site, the whole November window for him. And obviously, even with Joey's, you know, injury concerns, Joey can have them as well. So we definitely do need to even hammer home who is our third choice there, whether it is Ryburn or, you know, obviously he's put Jack Carty in ahead of the next guys in line to, you know, Billy Burns. As the next position, so that's probably still a bit unsure. But like the competition places is phenomenal. Even when Craig Casey came on the last day, like the zip he had of the ball, he certainly didn't look out of place. Bearing in mind he's coming in behind the pack that's going forward, and you know he's probably 20 points up already when he's coming on. So all these things have a part to play in the whole context of it. But still, he does not look out of place. If I'd see him come on, if he was on the bench, you know, half an hour into that Welsh game, I wouldn't be shaking my boots. I'd be like, all right, let's see what he's made of now, but I wouldn't be overly concerned either.
Yeah, that's the level we're at now, where you would hope that there is enough strength and depth for them to be able to withstand almost any injury crisis. But we kind of got through almost until the warm-up of the Argentina game through these three games thinking, actually, we've managed our resources very well here and we're not really missing any of our players. We do know from World Cups that by the time you come out of the group stages, when you reach the quarterfinals, it's at that point that you take a look at your playing stocks and they tend to be diminished. Is there any hope maybe that we're playing a slightly less abrasive game and that we, you know?
Yeah, I think, yeah, definitely, Joe. I think like even the context that we're making, like we still had a huge amount of rucks the last year. I think we were over the 100 mark on ruck. I think we'd retain 103 and lost like three or something, which is an incredible stat as well. But we're not just looking for collisions, we're looking for soft shoulders. So even the manner of those rucks, they're just a little bit less abrasive. It's not all the time, but it's a lot, you know, we're trying to come in at different angles. We're not just trying to create a ruck nearly for the sake of it and retain the ball and suck numbers in. And then obviously we're not trying to do it all the time. When we get an opportunity, we're trying to offload that ball out of contact, even in quite tight situations. For example, when Matter got his yellow card, like there was just a two or three knock-ons there in that contact zone that I don't think we would have seen in the Joe Schmidt era. It's just this idea of keep the ball moving, keep changing the point of attack. It doesn't have to be 100 rucks, 120 rucks a game. So hopefully that would help a certain amount, but also I think it's a good sign that, look, those injuries happened in the run up to the game, to Henderson and Jack Cohn, and even the likes of Nick Timoney, who's not even in the squad, is up in Belfast, comes down, ends up thinking he's just warming up, then realising he didn't get 20 minutes of game time and does particularly well as well. So the more of these players, I think it's 52 players that Alan Farrell has capped in total And the more these that are kind of exposed to his system, that whole defensive system, what my cat wants, then the better. Because we can see when the intervals are playing, we do have relative strength and depth in the country, but it's at club level. Like, it's whenever an Irish squad is announced, there's always like, what about this guy? What about this guy who's generally playing well, playing week in, week out for Ulster, Munster, Connacht, whoever, because, you know, the Leinster lads are all selected. But you know, it's exposing them. There's no point launching them, and then they need that exposure to the camps and to some international game time. So even that 20 minutes the last day has been invaluable for Nick Timoney.
I know we don't know the ins and outs of Andy Farrell's contract, but there's definitely a belief that Irish rugby is incentivised at various different levels to win prize money in the Six Nations. It's very hard for him, therefore, not to pick his best team in those games. You know, you manage your resources as best you can, and we can play some kind of a second string against Italy because Italy have fallen off the face of the earth. But wouldn't it be great if we were able to give Craig Casey and Balakoon and Timoney good, meaningful game time in Paris and at Twickenham, so they're aware exactly what that experience is like? Because there's a good chance that we're going to need those players in key moments in one of the three or four massive World Cup games that are coming. But if the first time they get those big moments are in Paris against France in a World Cup quarter final, then there's a more chance they're going to fail if they don't have any experience of that before.
Yeah, and again, it's just like you kind of framed the question at the beginning, like, what is the goal? Is it positioning out of Six Nations? I mean, there are a few, if you tell them officially, they'll say it's both, or is it World Cup quarter final stage? Yeah, I think yes and no, because as well, we've had a slight change in the guard. Like, let's say you're talking about Nick Timoney, like CJ Sanders gone. So as much as Jack Conan has all of a sudden come out and has become our first choice number eight up until probably, was it halfway through last season, or not even, maybe just, excuse me, after he was selected for the Lions and started for the Lions, we probably didn't know exactly who was going to be in that position. So I'm not sure how many times Jack Bone has gone and started away at Twickenham and away in France. And does he need that level of exposure just as much as Nick Timoney does, when he probably is going to be the starting? If we had to pick a team now, he's going to be the guy who's starting in a World Cup. Obviously, so much changes in 2 years. So I think it might be more a case of, okay, if a guy's out of form a little bit who was a guaranteed starter, if he's after picking up a knock, now we know these guys are there ready to step up. But I wouldn't necessarily rotate for those games, because you still need your best players exposed to those challenges year in and year out. And like Six Nations, as much as our June tour is very important and our November test is very important and our club rugby and our European Cup are, like, away to France and England are going to be the two biggest games of the year. They're going to carry the most weight for next season. So you still want your best guys exposed to that and getting used to playing with each other as well. Like, I think that was another reason he kind of didn't want to change the pack too much. And the thing is, we don't have, like, even the fact Andrew Porter now has gone to Lucid, and we've Ronan Keller in there. These aren't guys with 30 caps in their position either. So I think we do need to, I've had a really good November series, but now we're going to see something different with them. So they need to continue to work on their balance. And like, do we know where our best second row necessarily is either? Henderson obviously has had a few injuries since coming back from he did the rest from the Lions and then picked up injuries. So is it Ryan Byrne? And then when you've guys like a phenomenal freak like Ryan Baird breathing down their neck as well, I think these guys are going to be wanting their own game time against this French and English, those games particularly. Yeah.
Bundiaki's 31. He'll be 33 the time World Cup rolls around. That's fine, isn't it? 33 is the kind of outer limit, but anything after that, with the exception of Sexton, where like the age profile is reasonable, I suppose, is the point I'm making, that there's nobody really you can see being shunted out of the team.
No, I suppose Keith Earls is 34 now, but I mean, from listening to obviously his incredible interviews recently, like, he says he's as fast now as he was back then, and I wouldn't rule out that he'll still be there. But I think his role, as we can see even in the November test series, might be changing a little bit, but I wouldn't say is definitely gone, because he'd be 36. I just think the type of person and player he is, and the fact that he's such a utility cover now, I wouldn't rule him out. But after, besides Earls and Sexton, I think, yeah, you're probably looking at that age profile, all right.
I guess it then comes down to when some of those guys need rest, Louise, as opposed to when the management staff actually want to rotate. And if you're looking at the rhythm of the season, it may actually come down to that tour in New Zealand next summer, where a couple of those guys may be rested, even though it's probably one of the toughest places, if not the toughest place to go in rugby.
Yeah, maybe that's where the likes of Craig Casey gets his tour time, or Brian Baird, or, you know, Dan Sheen, that they get more exposed to these top level guys, because you can damn sure Kiwis are going to be absolutely baying for us down there. So that's where maybe you get more of your opportunity to try and blood these guys a little bit more. But it's very difficult to say, obviously, now, because it completely depends on how the season goes. But, you know, if Johnny Sexton's still going well, he's not going to put his hand up and say, you know, I'm okay for the June series this year when they're going down to New Zealand. I mean, fair enough, last summer it was, you know, Japan and USA. It was definitely a good opportunity to bring in some of the fringe players and see what they're like in international duty. But, you know, there's not a lot of guys going to be putting their hand down for this tour.
What do you want to see from Carberry then over the course of the next few weeks in particular? If we forget about the Six Nations and what he's going to do in the Ireland shirt, there was questions not only about him on the international level, but actually about a starting team in Munster over the past couple of months. So what does he need to do to kick on from a pretty successful November over the short term?
Yeah, I think he kicked pretty well, which even his start of the season with Munster, he wasn't as reliant off the boot maybe as he'd like to have been. Definitely seemed a bit ring rusty. Like, you wouldn't say Carberry was necessarily picked on form for his form against Munster, but more on what we know he can achieve, and kind of had that asterisk of knowing he has been carrying injuries and probably needed a little bit more game time as well to get up to speed. So I think it's to bring that Irish form and that confidence. Like, he looked confident the last day. He looked heads up. I actually thought his defence is really good as well. Argentina tried to run up over the top of him a few times off a few lineouts. And
yeah.
You know, fair enough, he had a back row coming in, usually, you know, Van der Fleer and Mahoney to help him out, but he was making his first up tackle. Might be sitting him back in their backside, but
the technique was good, though.
It's not a soaked tackle. I think he made 8 tackles in total in the game, and he looked pretty robust as well. Like, he didn't look like at any stage, you know, I don't think he ever got any medical attention during the game. And that cool to see him going to full back as well, just so we're having a look at that kind of second playmaker role. So I think with Munster, it's just to actually bring that confidence back in. Hopefully he'll have quite a strong pack in front of him as well that are pushing on. But I suppose on the flip side, if he isn't, how he manages those sorts of games as well. But it's good to see, like, he's kicking out of hand, his identification of space, that was definitely up. Once or twice he took it to the line, he identified that, you know, there's two forwards in front of him, glided through a gap, the show and go. So we saw a lot of the tricks that we're used to seeing from Joey, along with the solid consistency that we want from our 10. So I think just to bring that form back to Munster, and probably even to bring a little bit of leadership with them as well, because suppose when you're coming back from injury and you've had a couple of injuries back to back over the years and you've been away then international duty, mightn't be as hard for, even if you're an international player, to boss your provincial team around. But he really wants him to come back and kind of take ownership and boss Munster around the park now, and just, even, you know, be solid when he needs to be solid, and really back to expressing himself, because that was his point of difference when he first burst onto the scene, is that he could play this really nice running game. He took the ball to the line, he identified space, he did all these other things, as opposed to maybe someone who's really solid, really distributing 10 like a Ross Byrne, who, you know, you could say he's had a hard time of it as well, but it's a completely different type of player. Joey, his point of difference is that kind of running game, that kind of heads up ability to see what's in front of him and just react to it. So I think we're starting to see more of that. So to bring that into Munster definitely would be huge for the province.
Yeah, and now that we've kind of got a good idea of what the Mike Catt attack looks like as a result of what we've seen in November, which of the four provinces most closely resembles that? Like, is Carberry playing for Munster at the moment really good preparation for him when he does put on the green of Ireland again next year?
Yeah, like, I think Munster, like with Larkin as well, it looks like they're trying to play more expansive at times, but I think Leinster is probably the chance to start the question. Like, they're probably the team that most resembles, because they can win it both ways. They can play with a lot of integration of their backs and forwards, and they can play through their pack. Whereas I think with Munster, we're still looking at it. Maybe it's like Alan Farrell last season, where we're kind of wondering, we're getting a lot of positive sound bites, but wondering where we're actually going. Where there's a lot of resorting back to box kicking and playing behind our back and playing territory at times. And then there's games where they're excellent, but they've flattered to deceive a little bit at the start of this season as well. So I think Leinster are probably the team that's the most comfortable, and that's because they have been in that position of being, you know, the best team in the country, one of the best teams in Europe for nigh on 10 years now. So they have that confidence. They have that, I suppose, level of depth within their squad that know how to play that way. But yeah, I think with Joey at the helm, Munster can play a little bit more like that. It's just they need a lot more things to click than just Joey coming back and playing that way.
We should talk about what you think of what's happening in the women's game at the moment. Keir Griffin retiring, obviously, a fellow Kerry woman. She put in one of those all-time great performances that you really want somebody to put in at the end of a career. She's 27, and it seems like a shame for Irish rugby that somebody that young is being lost to the game. And it seems lost to the game, like, you know, there's no set plan. She hasn't announced what she's going to do next. You feel like if everything was going well, the IRFU would have stepped in somehow to make sure that their totemic leader was somehow being kept around. And it just feels like something is wrong at the moment with Irish women's rugby.
Yeah, look, first on junior, she's phenomenal. Phenomenal athlete, phenomenal leader in person. And to be honest, I was at the game last day, and it's rare I've seen a rugby game so influenced by one person. There was a bit of red card from, you know, 30 minutes into the game, 12-3 down against not a fantastic Japanese team. We're obviously struggling for form, for performance. I know we got two results over this window, but that's literally what we got, was two results, not two necessarily performances. And it was kind of a strange, almost like a purgatory, knowing Adam Griggs is still there and Greg McWilliams is sitting in the stand. But what Junior did was phenomenal. I know a lot of people see, oh, she scored two tries, but it's actually all over the field. Her defence, her attack was, if you saw a Japanese player being driven back, her scrum crap popped up. She was just hell-bent on putting a massive performance in, and she was phenomenal. So I'm delighted for her with that. I think it was always her plan to retire after the World Cup, and obviously when that didn't happen, she had to reassess. And look, it's difficult. Obviously, you know, there's a lot of talk about amateurism versus professionalism. The squad are in camps a lot, which is always obviously based up in Abbottstown. And with COVID as well, it's so difficult for Cuban to work as a primary teacher in Tralee with bubbles. And, you know, she's got a marriage, building a house. It's just, and she's such an all or nothing person. I can see why you look at it and say, this is physically impossible to spend so much of my time up and down the road to Dublin, when actually I want to start being at home a little bit more. And I've given an awful lot of my time. And the other thing is at rugby, I see a lot of people retire through injury, and she's such an abrasive player in one of those positions. It's pretty good that she can walk out of it in her own terms as well. And, you know, after such a fantastic performance, I suppose one side of it is, you know, you can have all the best plans to retire, and if things are going well, and if you're particularly happy and the setup is good and the squad are in a good place and you are that age and you can keep going, that's when, you know, minds get changed. But that wasn't the case. So I do think, you know, what's happened over the last few weeks hasn't had maybe a direct impact in that her decision was made. But if things were on the flip side much better, we all know, as whatever sport you're playing, like, I'll give it one more year, I'll give it another year, because I'm enjoying it so much. So
yeah,
I suppose that's what I'd say about that. And that's not coming from Junior at all. This is more kind of my own kind of thoughts on it, that, you know, if you're about to retire and you're like, but actually I can never go back, really, this is as good as it gets, and I, you know, I can manage to go one way, or the body can. But if you've a decision made and there's nothing there to really change your mind, then, you know, that's it is sad that way.
Yeah,
listen, she owes the jersey absolutely nothing, that's for sure. She certainly, you know, there's a bit of a cliche, leaving in a better place, but, you know, if ever someone has done it, it's Junior.
Your perspective on this is really interesting, because you came into the setup through the sevens, having watched the success of the 15s team, and then ultimately end up joining the 15s team as well. Did we just go about things the wrong way? Was there an original sin in separating the sevens and the 15s and kind of having a twin track approach and almost separating those two groups? Or was that the only available option for the IRFU, it just hasn't worked out for whatever reason. What's your instinct about where we are now and what the seeds of this, when were they sown?
Yeah, look, I think the original separation was done back in about 2013 when I believe John Scurr would have been managing Sevens, and it would have been around the end of Philip Doyle's time. Well, not the end, he was obviously there 2013, 2014. And there's a separation of sorts, and it was very much coming up to 2014 World Cup, and the 15 squad was going well, Sevens was kind of getting off the ground. And then Anthony Eddy came in as Sevens coach and head director of women's rugby and Sevens rugby around the, I think, December 2015 mark. And following Goose's retirement, Tom Tierney came in, and there was this kind of, I suppose, you know, this idea that you're contracted for Sevens, so that you are paid not an awful lot, but you know, and for that as well, you have to move up to Dublin and leave whatever job and life you have, whatever part of Ireland you live. And the ultimate goal was to qualify for the Olympics, and then you've been and qualified to get as a core team in the World Series. I need Sevens World Cup as well. So it was a pretty full-on calendar once you're on all those tickets. And I suppose there were players that were always crossing over and back along. I think even to take a step back, there are some people saying if you play Sevens, you shouldn't play 15s and vice versa. Every country in the world is doing it. So I don't agree with that for one second. England brought four players back in from the GP squad to play in the November International Series, and they don't necessarily need them. We could see how dominant they are. But it's how you do it that's important. And actually coming up to this window, it was done the best because there was no Sevens games. Actually, the first World Series is on this weekend against Dubai since January 2020. So the girls that were, I suppose, spearheaded to be involved or earmarked, they have been in for the last year or so, apart from, I think Lucy Mulhall was brought in a bit later for whatever reason. I'm not really sure why, to be honest. She'd been brought in earlier. So they were actually fully immersed. And when, you know, the squad, when players are brought up against each other, a lot of them were selected. I don't think the answer to Ireland's problems is that Sevens players are being selected. I think they do need to be immersed as much as possible, both within the club game and within the 15 squad as earlier as possible. And that is happening more than it happened a few years ago. But the 15s international girls also need to be immersed more in the club game. They don't play enough club games. They're not released. There's this idea that obviously the national squad is elite. And this is prior to COVID. Because COVID does add another layer because you're talking about bubbles, etc. But even prior to COVID, they weren't released enough, which meant the club game was suffering. You don't have as much strength and depth for someone who is playing with whatever club. It's very difficult to measure yourself up against the international standards because you don't see the international players right at any stage, and there becomes more and more of a gap. So that's definitely an issue. And I think just that the club in general needs more resources because since COVID has happened, if you weren't on that kind of circle of the international squad, the 15 squad, and they needed an extra player to pick from because either the 15 players out of form or was injured, they'd no option but to go into the Sevens squad because no one else is training or playing. The intros had started up, but that was too late. That was too close to the September window. And again, the fact that was set up that way just shows that it was never really set up as a feeder into the international squad. So I do think now, I'm not sure, I think Greg McWilliams' first camp might be around January time because our Six Nations happening in a later window. I think we need to see all those players that are playing the last two games back playing with their clubs, almost to obviously raise the standard within the club system, and also that he's a carte blanche to pick from across that whole structure. And as much as possible, they should be released back, because as much as the England women are professional, that's not why they're so good. It's a reason, but it's because of the investment back through the years, through the club game, through having an under 20 side. It's the development pathways. They're all linked with, you know, they're all teams like Saracens, Gloucester, they're all linked with, you know, professional men's clubs. And I know it's a different setup here with the provincial system, but we don't necessarily want to just copy what men do. We need to do a lot more kind of market research into what's going to work for a women's model. But certainly just A, making the senior team professional, or B, separating completely 7s and 15s and saying you can only play at one or the other are not the answer. That there still need to work together. But we definitely need a lot more investment and a lot more, I suppose, genuine people who give a crap about the club game and to try and just develop that as much as possible, that you're closing that gap at Interpros International, and that there's actually a pathway to see. Because otherwise, if I was 17, 18, 19, playing Gaelic football, which is, you know, thriving so much, soccer is coming up, other sports, and I'm playing rugby as well. Like, one of the reasons I left basketball to play rugby and Gaelic football is that there was no international senior team. So girls do start to look up along going, well, what's my goal here?
Yeah.
And if my goal here is, well, I don't even know how to make that team, I never even see those players, then you'll start to hemorrhage more and more players at that crucial stage where they're like sponges and should be developed more and more than 17, 18, 19 years of age.
Yeah. It's it is definitely important to have that pathway, and maybe that comes out in the review. We'll see the bit of the review that we'll get to see anyway. Louise, great to have you with us again. Thanks a million. Cheers.
Cheers, lad.
Louise Galvin, give us her thoughts there. Of course, played for the 17, played for the 15th, played basketball under 21 for Ireland, played football for Kerry. Not bad. Not a bad CV.
Yeah, pretty good. Really interesting stuff there at the end, actually, because it does seem that there is a couple of potential silver bullet ideas out there that, that come up every now and again, and clearly that's not the reason. And like, be interested to kind of hear a little bit more about that England situation as well, because we often point to them and say they're professional, that's why they're so good, but actually there are a hell of a lot more reasons. And maybe the lack of a thriving club game in men's rugby right now is actually having a knock-on impact on the women's game as well in some way or another. But yeah, it's really interesting to listen to her break it all down.
OTBAM with Gillette, proud sponsors of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow. We're doing all right, I think, even in a non-ironic way.
7 more days.
I know, this is Movember is not just for a mow, is not just for Movember.
No, it is. You didn't get that memo last year. It is literally November, just with an M at the start.
No, because I haven't finished mine. I said at the start it'll probably be Christmas or the New Year before mine's finished.
Oh, the Salvador Dali.
I'm committed to it. Right, we have loads of comments coming in
on Michael Carrick, by any chance?
I shouldn't have opened the Michael Carrick Pandora's box. I just shouldn't have, but I did. In the meantime, should we talk about what happened at the Principality? Because it's been a while since we talked rugby and Wales. Our Twitter feeds are normally aflame with the good people of the Principality of Wales, because, you know, it is a principality. They have a prince, sweet prince. And normally, whenever there's rugby on, my Twitter feed and Owen's feed, even though he is a rat who scuttled off the sinking ship when we got hulled beneath the water, when there's games on, it's like, whoa, what do you think of this? Blah, 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 blah. But curiously, they were quiet over the last 3 weeks.
Pretty disrespectful impression there of Welsh people, who I love.
As Ireland racked up basically 100 and whatever points it was in 3 games against first tier opposition, who have all beaten us horribly in big games in the World Cup. How did the Wales get on? Oh,
They did win against Australia.
They shipped 50 points against the All Blacks, did they?
They did, actually, at the very start. Shorn of a few players, though. We've got to give Wales their due.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, they did have their captain. And then they were going to beat South Africa, but an idiot Welsh fan stopped them from beating South Africa. I didn't think it was possible for a fan to stop you. Well, the fans can't win or lose a game, can they? Well, actually, it turns out, in Wales they can.
Yeah.
Wales have found a unique, brand new way to lose a game than I've ever seen before.
Yeah.
Drunken fan wandering onto the field and stopping you scoring a try, you're on end. I mean, if he'd done it, like, imagine how heroic it would have been if he'd done it while South Africa were pummeling over and he got in the way of Eben Etzebeth or Damian Dialenda, even, who would have crushed him like a twig. And
the pint would have gone flying out of his hand.
You know. I mean, it would have been amazing to see that happen. Yeah. Like, and he would then not have been showered in beer by all his own fans. In fairness to the Wales fans, they did the right thing. They showered him in beer. And
Showering a Welsh fan in beer is like the end of the Shawshank, though, really. It's like, yes, come on, let me feel it in all of my pores.
It's a reward. It's a mark of respect in some cultures.
100%, especially in Wales.
But we just have to say that nothing quite crowned the November internationals like this story today in the Telegraph.
Wales,
that
Wales,
Owen
Wales.
Is bringing us.
I'm so disappointed in Wales. So disappointed. I really, really got to like Wales over the last little while. On the front of the Daily Telegraph sports section, today's edition: fan vomits on 6-year-old boy.
What? What? Who? What country? Where is this, Owen?
A drunken spectator left a six-year-old boy in floods of tears.
Where?
After vomiting on him during the Wales victory over Australia on Saturday.
Puke. This game must have been in Australia, though, right?
Welsh rugby fans could face an alcohol clampdown after Joey Delaney's back and coat were covered in sick as he sat with his parents in the upper tier of the Principality Stadium during his first experience at a rugby match.
Say it ain't so, Joe. Poor little Joey.
Imagine that, bring your kid.
I mean, I have
to the
done
game
this.
For the first time. You brought your kid to an Ireland football game for the last time. Imagine an Ireland fan got sick all over them.
I can't imagine that. Our soccer fans are, you know, gentle. We are gentle souls. We are sweet princes. You are not sweet princes, Wales.
There were
six some details here.
So
make us puke over our frosties this morning.
So the BBC have done a bit of digging into this, and the boy's mother, Sophie, said that the intoxicated culprit did not say a word afterwards and appeared unaware of what he had done. Adding the supporter was slumped over his seat and obviously very, very drunk. It's just so bad. It's just obviously not a funny story whatsoever. It's
come on, get it
just,
together.
It's just terrible behaviour. Obviously,
what happened?
So, do you want to take over here? Because
no, come on, you can do it.
So she said there was sick everywhere. Joey was so upset and shocked. I had to stop myself from crying from seeing my son so upset and from the absolute shock of it all. The Welsh Rugby Union said it would review the steward's report following the incident, adding it was sorry to hear about the family's experience. It's not funny at all. It's just Welsh fans being Welsh fans, I guess. I'm really, really sorry that the Welsh fans have been tarred with this guy as well.
Not all Welsh fans, Owen. Hashtag not all Welsh fans.
Yeah, absolutely. So the WRU obviously have hit back at this, saying that it's not all Welsh fans, saying in excess of 275,000 fans have attended the Autumn Nations series games, and the vast majority of fans enjoyed themselves in a responsible and considerate way. It is our policy for staff to intervene if people are visibly intoxicated. Like, obviously, you mentioned there's been a couple of other things that have been done over the last little while. In Wales' game against South Africa, you mentioned a pitch invader who interrupted a Wales attack after running onto the pitch. You didn't mention the key part of that. It was part of a £20 bet with a friend. Wales and South Africa supporters close to the press box also engaged in a full-on brawl near the final whistle in the same fixture, with stewards intervening to calm things down. Previous alcohol-related incidents recently at the Principality have included a journalist's laptop suffering damage after being covered in a pint deliberately thrown into the press box by a drunk supporter. A married couple also complained this month after being left soaked in beer after a drunk spectator fell onto them from two rows above. Oh, that is just, I mean, that is just shocking for male supporters. I'm so, like, that is just desperate behaviour.
Horrific.
Two rows above.
A married couple.
I mean, they circumvented a row in the middle. Did they get catapulted above row D, went from row E to row C, and engaged in the those other spectators? So it's interesting that they complain after being left soaked in beer after a drunk spectator fell onto them from two rows. A supporter goes catapulting at you, and I would imagine that the spectator itself would have caused a bit of damage, not only to pints that that the spectator was holding. I'm sorry, this is obviously just something. Something needs to be done about this.
I'm just on Wales Online. I can't see the story anywhere on Wales Online this morning. Maybe they'll aggregate it later on from the Telegraph. But I'm looking at it. I don't see it.
I mean, we essentially experienced Wales fans catapulting on us from a height over the course of the Six Nations. So solidarity to the six-year-old boy. I know what you're feeling.
We have been puked on by the Welsh fans, metaphorically.
I've been vomited on, spewed on by Wales Online and Welsh journalists who like to take things quite literally. And we've been spewed on by certainly a man called Reese in my DMs, who pops up every so often, and David often pops up as well. It's been an interesting year for Wales, and congratulations to them on their win over Australia.
They're online world rankings at the moment. South Africa, England, France, New Zealand, we're fifth. Ireland are fifth, ahead of Wales, according to Wales Online. Maybe they're yarrowing us away. Right, OTBAM with Gillette, proud sponsors of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow. It would never happen at a football match, says Ashley on YouTube. Okay, I'm going to tell you about our latest Cadbury Road show. This is with Arsenal. It's with Robert Pires. I've actually already spoken to Robert Pires. He's going to be coming over the next few days. Katie McCabe has also done a brilliant interview with us about the setback that she suffered when she was at Glasgow and the recovery to now be one of the best players in the WSL. And I don't know if everybody knows, but Gerry Flannery spent a really interesting 12 months out of rugby and at Arsenal working with their strength and conditioning team with their senior academy players. He talks really well about the influence of Liam Brady in particular. So you don't want to miss our next Cadbury FC Roadshow. It's behind the scenes with the Arsenal squad. And it's all thanks to Cadbury FC and their club partnerships, granting you behind the scenes access at the Premier League's biggest clubs, coming soon to OTB Sports social channels. Robert Pires struggled with Gary Neville for some particular reasons. He says Neville was his most difficult opponent. We'll get the details of that on all our social channels in the coming days. It's all in association, as I said, with Cadbury FC and their club partnerships. Cathal is with us this morning to talk to us about the sports news. Cathal, good morning to you. How are you getting on?
Good morning. All well, lads.
Have you ever been puked on by a Welsh fan?
Not yet.
It's on your bucket list.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where are we starting today?
Well, some breaking news, actually, from the League of Ireland. Waterford have terminated the contract of their manager, Mark Burcham, just 3 days before their promotion relegation playoff against UCD. This one has developed fairly quickly in the last hour. So Burcham tweeted this morning to say that he had been suspended for a week by the club after a difference of opinion with the owner in a text message conversation last night. And Waterford have now taken the decision to end Burcham's term in the north and the southeast, rather. Having been appointed in May, the Englishman signed a two-year contract in August. He had given them a little bit of an upturn in form at that stage during the course of the summer, but this one has developed pretty quickly. So Mark Burcham's time in Waterford is over.
And it's not like the season is over for Waterford, is it?
No, they've got their promotion relegation playoff against UCD, so they've got a huge, huge game coming up.
And, right.
3 days before it, now they're managerless, so it should be interesting to see how that one pans out. But it's, as I say, it's just happened in the last hour. So he put out that tweet, and then Waterford have tweeted in the last, 20 minutes or so, that his time is over with the club. So Waterford on the lookout for a new manager. Elsewhere on the managerial front, with Manchester United in Champions League action tonight, of course under the stewardship of Michael Carrick after the sacking of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer over the weekend. They take on Villarreal in the Champions League this evening. That's a 5:45 kickoff. It's the club's first match, of course, since Solskjaer was sacked on Sunday. Michael Carrick is in temporary charge, and he says he'll stay in charge for as long as he is needed.
Obviously know the boys very well, know the staff very well, know the club very well. This club's been my life for an awful long time now, and so, you know, it's the sacrifice and dedication that you've got to get and you've got to give. I'm prepared to do that, obviously, however long it takes. I'm prepared to do that for, whether it's one game, whether it's two games, whether it's a little stretch longer than that.
So that's Michael Carrick. Kickoff, as I say, for that one in Spain tonight is at 5:45. Elsewhere, Chelsea can move level on points with Group H leaders Juventus in their encounter. Those two sides clash at Stamford Bridge from 8. A point will be enough for Chelsea to secure their passage through to the knockout stage. Elsewhere in some other soccer news this morning, domestically, Shamrock Rovers defender Roberto Lopez, Bohemian striker Georgie Kelly and St. Pat's midfielder Chris Forrester have been nominated for the PFAI Player of the Year award. It's Lopez's second nomination in as many years. Kelly and Forrester, of course, will square off in the FAI Cup Final this Sunday at the Aviva Stadium. And speaking of Cup Finals, Shelburne say they won't be launching an appeal surrounding last Sunday's Women's FAI Cup Final. The Wexford Youths won that game 3-1, but then reports emerged yesterday suggesting that the FAI had launched an investigation into the eligibility of one of the Youths players introduced off the bench. But in a statement last night, Shell said they did not make a complaint, nor do they intend to do so, and they congratulated Wexford on their victory. Elsewhere in football this week, the Republic of Ireland, of course, continued their World Cup qualifying campaign. They continue their preparations today as well. Slovakia are the visitors to Tala Stadium on Thursday. That's before a meeting with Georgia at the same venue on Tuesday. There was a couple of players drafted into the squad yesterday, including the England-born goalkeeper Megan Walsh of Brighton, Ellen Molloy, Leanne Kiernan and Claire Walsh have all been forced to withdraw due to injury. And the Ireland midfielder Jamie Finn has been speaking ahead of the game and insists that 6 points is the goal for their upcoming qualifier. She says that they need to build on last month's win away to Finland.
We need to go into every game that we can beat these teams and get the 3 points and no disrespect to any opponent we play against. I think you have to go into every single game with a positive attitude and that you're going to come away, you're going to perform well as a team, as a unit and get the 3 points. And I think that the Finland game away was brilliant and like what a result away from home. And I think we need to bring that into this camp now. All the positives that was in that game and really drive forward.
Yeah, so a big couple of games coming up for the Republic of Ireland women's team. Some breaking Gaelic Games news this morning as well. Mayo's Cullen Boyle has announced his retirement from intercounty football. He won 4 All-Stars and 6 Connacht medals during his career with the Westerners. He made a total of 120 appearances for the county. So Cullen Boyle's time with Mayo is over. And elsewhere in Gaelic Games, some sad news last night. The former Limerick All-Ireland winning hurler Eamon Ned Ray passed away at the age of 77. He won a Celtic Cross with the county in 1973. He also collected 2 Munster titles during an 11-year inter-county career. Elsewhere this morning in cricket, the Ireland women's cricket team, they're currently in World Cup qualifying action in Zimbabwe at the moment. They're up against the West Indies. This one got underway at about 7:30 Irish time. They're currently 69 without loss. That's after just over 17 overs. They were put into bat first by the West Indies, who won the toss, and Ireland faced the Netherlands and Sri Lanka in their other group matches later this week. And 2 other small bits just to finish up in snooker. The UK Championship gets underway in York today. Kyron Wilson is among the early players out there this afternoon in the afternoon session. And in racing, there's an 8 race card at Punchestown this afternoon where the first goes to post at 12 midday.
All right, Carl, good stuff. Thanks a million for that. It is 8:51. I'm just doing some quick reading about Mark Burcham's time at Waterford. He's given a new 2-year deal in August, and here we are in November and he's out. But the match, I don't know if you remember the firework being on the field of play after Rovers had just won the title. The Rovers fans let off a firework in that game. I'm very surprised that there wasn't an automatic victory awarded to Waterford for that. That would have been
multiple fireworks,
fairly standard. That's an automatic 3-0 win for you. But actually, they lost that game 3-1. And in the press conference afterwards, Mark Burcham said that he was disgusted by his players. I'm disgusted at my players. We don't deserve to stay up. If we defend set pieces like that, we don't deserve to be in the league. From the 91st minute in the Derry game, we've let 3 of the worst set pieces in that I can see. We let another corner in tonight and a wide free kick where someone's headed into the middle of our box and no one's made contact. They know their jobs. The players know who they are, those that have let us down. The players have let a lot of the team down in the last 2 games, and if we defend set pieces like that, we don't deserve to be in the league. It's disgusting. They're not doing their jobs. When it comes to the pressure time of the season, they're not doing their jobs, so it doesn't matter how well we play.
Fair play.
This is
The fireworks was a pretty easy scapegoat there.
He actually said he wasn't blaming the fireworks. There's a great quote about the fireworks. When asked whether they had any impact on the result, not at all. Now, that's not an issue. Fireworks on the pitch, it was a bit dangerous, but did it affect the set pieces? The fireworks had no impact on the set pieces, unless perhaps it was distracting the players from what they were doing. So, interesting character.
Yeah, God, it's...
Now he's gone.
Now he's gone. It's quite a League of Ireland story, isn't it? This whole thing, and obviously in such a pivotal few days for the club as well, it's going to be interesting to see how that one plays out. But you know, I admire that honesty. I admire the sort of we'll focus on what we can control, because Shamrock Rovers fans letting off fireworks is not something we can control.
It's been a bonkers League of Ireland season, and it ain't over yet. It's 8:53 this morning. We're chatting to Kilkenny's Owen Murphy next. Still to come, we're talking Champions League with Graham Hunter after 9.
OTB AM.
Okay, so Avonmore Protein Milk are teaming up with Dublin footballer Brian Fenton and Kilkenny hurler Owen Murphy to launch the new Avonmore Pro Oats product. Fenton and Murphy, who have 9 All-Ireland Championship medals between them, were representing the Gaelic Players Association, of whom, along with the GAA, Avonmore Protein Milk are a long-standing supporter. As you can see, Owen Murphy is with us now. Owen, congratulations. County champions, Glenmore. I presume it's been one hell of a week.
Yeah, Owen, listen, thanks a million for having me on. It's been a great few days, to be honest. This is a nice way to finish off the week as well, just coming up, getting a trip back to Croke Park and that as well. But brilliant celebrations, and thankfully we don't win too much now, to be honest.
Yeah, so this was the Intermediate Championship. How long had you been in the Intermediate for?
So we got relegated in 2005, back out of senior. Right. So it's been that long, 16 years. And, we spent a year in junior in between that then as well. And so, we've been building for the last couple of years, and we've a huge amount of young players that have, shown huge amount of ability, have played schools level at a really high level, and have, played at inter-county level, minor, 20s and that as well. So, but it's only so long, I suppose, that you can class a team as young. And there's no better time to win something than now. Do you know what I mean? So, we've enjoyed it for a few days. We haven't got word just yet of when we're going back, but we're looking forward to it, and we'll give the Leinster Championship a crack as well.
How does a week like this compare to winning an All-Ireland with Kilkenny and the sort of national and obviously county-wide story that is and the madness of it all?
Look, to be honest, it means much, much more, simply because, look, for as long as I can remember, I've been down in our pitch at home, and my mum has watched the jersey. She's chairperson at a Camogie club at home. My dad has been chairperson. He fixes the hurls. My brother makes the hurls. Uncle makes the hurls. We just have a huge connection with the club. And, we are a tight bunch then as well. And, there was a huge, huge sigh of relief. I was beaten in 5 intermediate semi-finals up till when we won our semi-final a couple of weeks ago. And, we've never just fell over the line at that stage. So there was just a huge sense of relief getting over the semi-final. And we discussed it, among ourselves, that these would be the best days of our lives, if we could pull this off. And, and to enjoy it as well, sort of to express it, because you can get to a final and, you can be, caught up in the moment and maybe forget how big of an occasion it is. And I think you just, you need to take a step back and realize that these don't come around too often. And we had a bit of a slow start. First 15 minutes, we were sluggish. We're 6 points down. And we just started turning the screw then. Lads stepped up to the plate big time. And just everyone, it was just a huge amount of emotion afterwards, to be honest.
How does your role for the club differ to your role for the county? Is there any sort of Shane Curran style making runs up the pitch or anything like that?
No. I'm the centre back calling everyone back, so I don't get to do too much marking. I'm playing centre back in my club now for the last couple of years, and I've always played off field from a club own, to be very honest. So, I'm happy enough with that. I can feel I can can contribute to our game out the field and that as well. And I play absolutely anywhere, and I've always said that, in Kilkenny. And I know it's sort of a bit of a cliche thing, but from when I was knee high, 3-4 years of age, whatever age it was, and we were hurling out in our lawn, or as we call it, the little pitch outside at home, you just play anywhere at all, and you just love playing hurling. And at the end of the at the end of all that, I know everybody enjoys playing it, but you can't beat winning then after that. And it's been a great week all around.
It's not exactly a great hiding place if you're coming from between the sticks to go out to centre back. It's as important a position as there is. So, that's obviously something that I guess underlines the modern hurling goalkeeper, right? There's top class hurlers in between the sticks these days.
Yeah, look, and to be fair, Owen, I think the last couple of years, the fact that there's been a split season, and that has helped me hugely. It's hugely beneficial for a club player anyway, because at least they have a defined season. They know exactly when they're going to be playing, not just when the inter-county team gets bet into championship, which I think, how long is a piece of string? You just don't know. So, from my point of view, I'm back, I'm training as an outfield player. So that sharpness and that, being able to read the game, that helps me, because I get a set period of time playing out the field, playing with the boys in that position. As you said, it is a pivotal position. But then also, the way the Kilkenny Championship used to run before, back maybe 3-4 years ago, if we played a Leinster game, we would have a club game the week afterwards. And that was just the way the league was ran. And, I used to find that extremely hard, because You know, you're going from a 4 or 5 week block playing in the goal and training in the goal. Everything is veered to, you know, my set position with Kilkenny, and, you know, I'm going back out and trying to play midfield, centre back, centre forward, wherever I used to be playing with my club. I used to find that hard in a 1 week window. You know, so yeah, it suits me the last couple of years the way it's been run off. And look, as you said yourself, the fact that I'm in a, you know, a very privileged position playing with Kilkenny, being an inter-county player, you know, we have to be leaders for a club and, you know, be shown to be doing the right things as well. So, like, the fact that I can, you know, be performing somewhat and driving on lads around me, that's a huge plus as well from the position I'm in with Kilkenny, you know.
If we could just talk about goalkeeping for a minute then, Owen, because it really seems to be a talking point over the last couple of years, how people like yourself and Nicky Quaid have really up the bar completely. It's almost gone in tandem with football, where the goalkeeping is definitely some of the, I guess, most innovative and high quality that we've seen ever in the game. Like, why is that, do you think? What's the sort of work that you've put in and the sort of innovations that you've brought to your game that's allowed this increase in standard to happen?
Well, you know, I always found that I was really comfortable on the ball anyway, Owen, because of my playing days out the field with Glenmore and with the college when I was in WIT. And yeah, so I just found that I was really comfortable on the ball. But I think now, if you're not used to being on the ball and shown for the ball in particular, it's an extra outlet for the backs. And then how you distribute the ball when you're in play, like when you're in possession. So be it from restart, be it from play, like, it's hugely important now. Where, look, if you can retain possession, primary possession, like, that's half the battle. The other team then have to work twice as hard to get it back off. Like, so. And that's the way teams are playing now. It's you know, and I think Limerick have probably redefined the possession game as well, in comparison to the Cork team back in, say, mid to early noughties, 3, 4, 5, and 6, that area. But where it was might be in a little bit more of a hand passing sort of running game, Limerick have very similar, but it's 30-40 yard drilled passes to players. And as I said, they just redefined that. And Nicky Quaid is, you know, I said in an interview a couple of years ago, Nicky Quaid has been one of the best goalies in the game for the last, I don't know how many years, and probably didn't get the recognition he deserved at that time because, look, Limerick weren't winning All Ireland, they weren't winning Munsters at that stage. And he's getting his due rewards now, absolutely. You know, and I think teams, if they're coming up against Limerick, like, obviously there is a couple of key players that you have to pinpoint and you want to maybe have a game plan to counteract them. And Nicky is certainly one of those. He's definitely the best there at the moment.
And that's been really evident in terms of what you mentioned there, the understanding that you have of the outfield positions, the contribution to open play. But the basics seem to have gone up a notch as well, the shot stopping. Like, from your own perspective then, is that something that you're constantly working on? Is there drills that you do to try and keep your sharpness? Because, like, pardon the pun, but there are cat-like reflexes quite often from your own perspective in big moments and big matches.
Yeah, look, and I think, you know, everybody's knowledge of strength and conditioning now, I think, has probably allowed me, even though I'm into my 30s now, to stay what I feel physically now probably in the best shape that I've ever felt I've been in, even my mid-20s. And I know what works for my body now. And obviously Mickey Comfort coming in then the last couple of years, introducing a few more things to your strength and conditioning programs, your off-season programs as well, on that helps hugely. So you know, yeah, like I think there is stuff that you do in the off-season, the stuff you do in between your sessions as part of your gym programs, like that adds something to it. But in training, yeah, look, I'd be constantly working with Darren Brennan and, you know, James McGarry and that too. And, you know, and you're trying to go through drills that you feel might be like game-like scenarios. But look, you know, there's only so much that you can replicate in that regards too. At the end of it, look, it's you know, sometimes you guess that split second, you know, you guess correctly. And it's such a small margins. Like, you know, you take a penalty, some of the top players, and they're taking a shot from 21 yards out. And, you know, and I can I can try turn around and read Aaron Glenn's shot. I can try read Patrick Horgan's, whoever it may be that's going to be taking a penalty. And, you know, if he throws a half a dummy and goes the other side, you look like a fool. But like, if I guess the right way, you know, it's you're a genius sort of thing. So it's very, very small margins, to be honest.
And would you have been watching Patrick Horgan take penalties on video before that All-Ireland semi-final?
Yeah, you would. You know, and similar enough, a couple of years ago in the semi-final against Limerick, you know, I would have watched Aaron Glenn taking some of them as well. That day he threw me the wrong way. So, you know, I was looked like a bit of a clown at that stage. But look, that's just the way it goes. And that's what you have to do. But like, if you take in any of the backs or whatever it is, they're going to be looking at forwards, individual clips and seeing exactly what is their favourite side, or, you know, what way did he like a ball coming in, and what way, you know, I suppose, does he not like the defender attacking the ball? You know, so everybody goes into that finer detail now. We have access to a bundle of information now between video clips and, as I mentioned, strength and condition, nutrition, everything. So that's where everything is just going to the next level. And if you're not taking that on board, I think you're going to be left behind.
Arthur O'Dea, who works with us at a piece with Colm Callanan and James Gehill over the last couple of days, and Colm Callanan was telling the story about this Christy O'Connor drill. I'm not sure if you fell victim to this as well, but he said he had to stop the car and pull over for a while after training to down a couple of bottles of Lucozade Sport. Such was the reddening he got off Christy O'Connor, to put it in Christy's own words. Is that the level of drills that you're being subjected to in training as well?
Yeah, look, I may have a chat to Colm about that and see what he passes on that drill. But yeah, it would be. And, right, you know, you train. Like,
how does
now,
that actually happen? Like, what is the drill?
Well, that particular drill, I haven't seen the clip now, so I may look back over it. I've sort of been offline now for the last couple of days. But yeah, no, I look back on it. But like, we do reaction drills as well, where you have a bundle of maybe 20 balls, about 20 plus yards from goal. And, you know, as soon as you save one or there's a shot taken, you're taking a step out to it. So by the time, you know, you're getting down to the last letter, it's probably only 10, 12 yards. And like, obviously you have to cover the angles behind you and the goal. You just have to, you know where you're on the pitch at any one time. And that's one of my favourite ones as well. And it's just pure reaction drill. If it hits off you, it hits off you. Do you know what I mean? You have to get used to that. And, you know, it's like the tackling drills and training that the outfield players are doing as well. They're just conditioning themselves to game-like scenarios, to be honest.
I presume you're long past the point of taking any notice of taking a belt of a slitter, even on a cold night.
Yeah, well, even on a cold night, no, listen, any goalkeeper that tells you he doesn't think about getting a thing of a slitter on a cold January night now, he's definitely lying, I can tell you that. But no, listen, yeah, you would be. You do get used to it. Look, it's much easier to take one during the summer than it is in the winter, I'll tell you that.
There has to be a madness though there as well, though, and I'm sure, like, where you kind of just compartmentalise, whether it's going up for a high ball or bursting out of the defence with the ball in your hand or shot stopping, there has to be a sense of, you know what, I need to put my body on the line here regardless as a goalkeeper.
Absolutely. And do you know what, sometimes you just don't even think of it, like, because a lot of the things are so instinctive. Like, if you take that split second to think about maybe what you're doing, like the process of it, like that split second is too late. And yeah, so it's you know, you're just trying to expose yourself and train and look back to that. And honestly, I am a believer, you train the way you want to play, like how you play on the day then will be as a result of how you've trained over the last however many couple of weeks or whatever it is between games and things like that as well. So yeah, I'm a big believer of that.
And how do you see the role of the goalkeeper changing over the next little while? Is there going to be more influence, do you think, on your role?
I think it's probably getting to a stage now where maybe from a hurling goalkeeping point of view is whether we're going to take the next step to the likes of Niall Morgan and, you know, and those guys who are basically like the fly keepers in the football. You know, and you see it in the Ulster final here. It was amount of bravery, I suppose you could call it. But again, they're so comfortable being on the ball and coming out and taking these balls in as well, confident in their own amount of ability. So maybe, I don't know, is that the next step in hurling goalkeeping? But the thing is, you know, if you get whoever we'll say in the half back line of the opposition team, you know, they're going to drive the ball 90 yards. So if you're anyway off your line, like they'll be able to score a goal. So, I'm not so sure on it. It's an interesting one. Mm. Look, and, you know, I suppose when I first came in, I would have been asking about the sharp puck outs. What were you feeling of it? What do you think of it? And I think now it's just an acceptance that you have to be, you know, apt at taking sharp puck outs and being confident in your own ability to take sharp puck outs and your own players' abilities, your teammates' abilities, for taking the puck outs as well. Like that's a given now. But you know, back 2011, 12 or 13 would have been my first year and I was asked about it. And, you know, and I said, I don't mind giving a sharp puck out. Is it only a 20, 30 hour pass? Like, and, you know, and that was a thing for a couple of years. But now, as I said, it's just, it's a given. You have to do it.
Yeah, there'll be centre-backs playing in goals for every team before long. you have been listening to Kilkenny's Owen Murphy, who's teamed up with Avonmore Protein Milk to launch the new Avonmore Pro Oats products. Murphy, who and Brian Fenton, who we'll be talking to later on as well, have 9 All-Ireland Championship medals between them, and they were representing the Gaelic Players Association, of whom, along with the GAA, Avonmore Protein Milk are a long-standing supporter. Owen, congratulations again on last weekend. Best of luck now with the rest of the winter and into next year. Thanks a million.
Owen, cheers. Thanks a million. OTB
AM. Yeah, really interesting stuff there. And if you haven't checked out that piece by Arthur O'D on the website, you should, particularly if you've had any interest in that, because the madness of the goalkeepers is right there, writ large. It's 10 minutes past 9 this morning, OTBAM with Gillette, proud sponsors of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow. Right, we've got Graham Hunter with us, I think. Yeah? Graham, good morning to you.
Morning, lads.
What's the crack? How are you?
Yeah, super. Yeah, just back from some filming in Valencia and Seville, with filming in Bilbao to come this week, but the Champions League in the middle with Barca under pressure.
I mean, the Barcelona story is incredible. The Real Madrid story is pretty incredible. And the fact that so many names being linked with the Man United job have some kind of Spanish connection means that this is quite a delicious period. Jurgen Klopp said he hated the international break. We actually quite enjoyed the international break for a change. I suspect maybe you did too. The atmosphere
loved it for several reasons. You're obviously referring to Spain and their ease of qualification. There's no hint about you even mentioning mighty Scotland and the way in which we demolished the world's unofficially number one ranked in Denmark. Yeah, look, the international break this time I thought was particularly vibrant. And, you know, I find myself deeply intellectually challenged for about the 10 millionth time talking to you two, in that I hate the way that we treat our footballers. I hate the way we treat them as commodities and squeeze every last drop of physical availability and also mental creativity out of them. We're treating them somewhere between cattle and products. Yet I am one of those that the more football I see, the more that's available, the more I get a chance to go to games, talk to footballers after games, the happier I am. So I accept the contradiction, but if you give me a chance, just a glimpse at the Scotland side, I was sitting on Friday night with ex-Scotland manager Craig Brown. He couldn't remember a game where he'd either been working or watching, but he'd seen Scotland play better. And he meant it at 81 that he couldn't remember a better performance than the one against Denmark. Maybe that's a little bit exaggerated, but the quality of football was absolutely superb.
And the atmosphere.
They're being well-coached. To have, after the 2 years that we've been through, to have fans back initially was brilliant. To have fans back initially for Scotland was a mixed blessing, because there were deep doubts about the quality of football, the progress over the last 6, 7, 8, 9 years easily. To go from where there was a fervour for Scotland being represented in a tournament again in summer, but clear gaps about how to handle the bigger sides, how to handle sides that wanted to attack you, to now, where the learning has been ultra rapid, right across the technical staff and the squad, there's a clear understanding of how to play against bigger, better teams. Not necessarily turn them over, we're not suddenly world beaters, but the tactical nous, but then the confidence, and that's transmitted to fans. The Hamden was jam-packed full. Yes, the atmosphere was brilliant, but I tuned in only on television this time to the game the next day, where Wales were playing in Cardiff Stadium, and the atmosphere there was absolutely roasting. It was so good. So to have teams that matter to me playing well in front of full houses, it's something that seems next to a dream, next to impossible after so many years of a dearth of success for Scotland, but then 2 years without crowds in stadia. It's just fantastic. But Spain played well. Don't forget Spain played well. And over the next 4, 5, 6 years, I expect Spain to be in direct competition to lift trophies.
Well, they've got a slew of young kids, who many of whom are coming through at Barca at the moment. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But the Spain job in particular, if we could all tap Ronald Koeman on the shoulder and say, don't leave, don't take that job. It's a poison chalice, and you're doing really well at the moment. If you just stay with the Dutch, you're going to have a good time. He didn't. I suspect Luis Enrique is not as stupid as Koeman, and will not be in any way interested or entertained by the prospect of taking the Man United job, even though apparently he is Ronaldo's chosen successor. Is there anything in this at all? Anything beyond a flight of fancy?
I know that you've lit the blue touch paper and you're now standing well back. I know you know how much I think the story is garbage. I don't know where it came from. And if somebody has spoken to Cristiano Ronaldo or directly to Jorge Mendes, who tends to be his mouthpiece, and this is coming from them, then it's the most bizarre story ever. And I'll tell you why. Before we even look at what Luis Enrique Martinez might or might not do, if you've watched his football from the very days that he took over at Barca B, the moderate season at Roma, what he did at Celta, Barcelona, onwards to Spain, Cristiano Ronaldo right now is the epitome of the type of footballer that Luis Enrique doesn't want in his team. He's not particularly attracted to stars in the first place, but right across the board, whoever you are, however much he has liked you, however much he hasn't liked you, but you're vital, if you're not running and pressing and working and trying to win the ball back, anytime his team, Luis Enrique's team, doesn't have the ball, you're out. That's it. Goodbye. And possibly goodbye forever. And at the moment, and probably for the last few years, increasingly since the success of Barcelona, he's ultra about his own beliefs. It's not as if he was a flip-flopper before, but like, you probably get one warning, and then you're out. Now, imagine in some ludicrous world, Luis Enrique leaves Spain, takes over at Manchester United. Cristiano Ronaldo is maybe getting biscuit crumb minutes at the end of games, not because of any personal antipathy, but because Luis Enrique believes in a particular style that Cristiano Ronaldo, because of his age, cannot fulfil. So, also, there's something that needs to be said. Cristiano Ronaldo, for whatever you think about him, is football bright and is very shrewd, street smart about his own career. The idea that he might be saying, I want this guy to come to the club where I'm working, in the full knowledge that he'd be dropped, it's just, honestly, it's... The whole concept stinks of rotten fish.
Okay. Does the concept of Guardiola wanting Ronaldo in the summer also stink of rotten fish by the same criteria? Was that true?
I can't remember if we talked,
I don't think we did,
show or not, but for my taste, and I got some nudges, I got some help on this, it was a corporate thing, it was a club idea. I'll say three things. One, Cristiano Ronaldo is in no way responsible for the mess that Manchester United are in right now. Two, at the time he signed for Manchester United, with Alex Ferguson's intervention, everybody was hailing it as a great coup. So at the time when Manchester City wanted him, you can vouch for the concept or not analytically. You, the viewers, I can do it too. You can say, good idea, bad idea in sporting terms. But could you see it in commercial terms? Could you see it in City being able to wave two fingers up at Manchester United? Could you see it in terms of attracting more attention to City? Yeah, you could see it. One thing that Pep Guardiola has said continuously throughout his career, he will go and object about things he doesn't like to his employers, but there's been a constant mantra of, I'm an employee. He's had to do things across his career that he hasn't particularly liked or enjoyed, and there will come a stage, just like Luis Enrique, and I see the jump that you make because of the way both of them like to play, the fact that you know, maybe City do lack a scorer because they couldn't get Kane, all this kind of stuff. To my mind, it was a City project with very little interest from Pep Guardiola in it. But Luis Enrique and Guardiola are not the same man. Luis Enrique is much, much, much more hawkish than Pep, believe me.
Right, interesting, because it didn't seem like it would make sense. And it's a terrible idea for him. I know the money might be more, but like, go win your World Cup, either now or the next one, and then whatever job you want is yours for life, and you can name your paycheck. And it's not like he needs the money anyway. So, what Zidane, not going to happen, a good idea, bad idea, what do you think?
Look, number one, in tactical terms, one of the things that's really, really important about Zidane is that he is the player whisperer. He is the guy who can go to either slightly out of form, slightly misunderstood, perhaps slightly jaded great players and talk them through the rehabilitation, who can ensure that there's a daily climate set where very good and great players thrive. I don't think he has ever tried to masquerade as one of these obsessive strategy tactical coaches. He fits into the bracket of what was a different age between you two and me, but we all grew up in Britain and Ireland with much more of a concept of manager, somebody who managed a squad. There'd be a coach to his side, two or three coaches sometimes, but the manager managed them, was really good at the dressing room, with atmosphere, with orders, with setting a tone. That's Zidane, and that, you will know better than me, is not what Manchester United need right now. They need crystal clear. They need one of these intensive interventionist coaches who says, this is the way we're playing. You're not doing that anymore. We need to do that. The space between all these things that we've become used to saying, and none of these names, I mean individually, but there's a bracket of Unai Emery, Lopetegui, Benitez, Pep Guardiola, Luis Enrique, coaches who are like, this is the way it's going to be. There'll be no Conte. I mean, it's one of the great on goals of modern times, that if United were on the point of saying one bad defeat and Solskjaer's out, that they didn't just go and get Conte. It defies belief. So Zidane as a concept at Manchester United, I think, would be likely to be an ill fit with what they need and what he's offering. He wants the Paris Saint-Germain job. I now don't have much doubt that Pochettino will somehow goad Leonardo, the ultra irascible, ultra pompous PSG sports director, to a point where they're willing to let him go. And I'd now be a little bit surprised personally if it's not Pochettino to Manchester United at some stage, depending on how accelerated that can become, and Zidane to Paris Saint-Germain.
And do you still maintain, Graham, then, that missing out on Conte would have been is a bad moment for Manchester United? You have Conte in a level above Pochettino.
I have him as different. I think another evolution in the coaching market in recent years, to do with many more billionaire foreign owners across Europe, where patience is short. The Abramovich model having been seen and copied by equivalent elite clubs around Europe. There are managers, Ancelotti is one, Conte is another, where you're betting that what you get is a 2, maybe maximum 3-year infusion of caffeine, where all standards are changed, where the daily intensity can bring burnout, but will almost always bring massive improvements. No real attention paid to whether academy players can come through or not. It's all about win this second, win this hour, win this day, win this month, win this season, win trophies. Everything is now, now, now. Ultra, ultra hothouse intensive. Conte is that. Then the likelihood is that he'll ask too much upwards. He doesn't manage upwards particularly well. It's these are my standards. I want this player, that player. If you can't bring him, then I'm out of here. And that's precisely what United need right now. He was the identikit of what they needed. He probably wasn't the 5-year, 6-year man. Pochettino might be. He's clearly a developer. He is a good coach. He clearly has footballing ideas within his skill set that match with the general image that the fans and the sponsors have of the club. Let's leave Ed Woodward out of this argument, because it's incredible that people are still talking about what should be done at Manchester United, and Mourinho was this and Vergara was this and the players, and it's Woodward. Couldn't be more simple. You can't sack the owners. They're at fault here. Woodward has been a disastrous presence for Manchester United. But within the scope of that not being something that's imminently going to change, in fact, he's so good at his job, he's apparently going to stay on and oversee all his successor. Good move, United. Fantastic. Yeah, salute that. Pochettino is patently somebody around whom there are doubts. One of the things I've said on your show before, but when Bayern Munich were scouting him as a potential replacement for who was a Croat manager, at any rate, a Croatian manager that they needed to replace, and they did do with Flick, they looked at him. Salihamidžić watched Pochettino really closely and said, he's slow to make changes within games. You see a situation, he's conservative, he's a bit reactive. So there are things there. There are things about how soon he allays the idea about trophy winning in a place where it's not, you know, shooting fish in a barrel like it is at Paris Saint-Germain. Personally, I think that if you only look at the little flaws, little Achilles heels, and ignore the talent, then that's a mistake. And Pochettino would be the longer term, the developing coach, who, if it clicks, you can imagine being there for 5-6 years, which sets him apart from Conte in personality and attitude and daily regime. But if you want accelerated change, immediate impact, it was Conte.
Right. Obviously, that's gone now. So they're left with Pochettino. It doesn't seem like a million other viable candidates, because, you know, you can give the job to Brendan Rodgers, fair enough, but like Leicester aren't doing great
at
the moment.
Hold on. Viable candidates. What does that mean? They missed a trick. Right, I got back to my Woodward argument, because you've dangled a, you know, red rag. Irrespective of what kind of job Darren Fletcher is going to do there, he's rather new in the door. What you're getting is agents influencing Woodward. They've missed three huge tricks at United. The first one was Ancelotti. When Ancelotti was going back to Real Madrid, the idea of saying to him, we know that you can manage in situations where it's as difficult, for example, under Berlusconi, as it is under the Glazers and Woodward. He also has the wisdom and the solutions to alter things, to make that they would not be in the situation they're in now if they'd hired Ancelotti. The other trick they've missed is Conte, we talked about him. And for my taste, the trick they've missed is Xavi. Because Xavi is extraordinary, speaks English perfectly, and is going to be outrageous. He's going to be an outrageously talented coach and manager. And for my taste, that won't always be at Barcelona. There'll come a stage. And that's one of the things that I would have done. People now are looking at, it has to be tried and tested. I don't think that's true. Xavi is so talented, and he was available, and you could have given Barcelona a bloody nose. And at the moment, Barcelona and Manchester United aren't as nose-to-nose rivals as they were for 5 or 6 years between 2008 and 2011, 2012, 2013. However, those two tricks are missed. And you know, laugh off Xavi if you disagree with Conte, if you disagree with Ancelotti, because, oh, we had a couple of bad months at Everton. But the truth is, it's evidence of, allied to the way that they're thrashing around right now, it's evidence of how poor Woodward's grasp of needing to have a proper strategy is, and how poorly he consults. You know, it's something that is deeply frustrating. And if it begins to cost the jobs or the futures of potentially really important men to Manchester United, like Carrick, like Fletcher, because there's an overhaul coming, then that'll be another own goal. And to my mind, the idea that fans at United want to protest about the Glazers is important, but probably futile in the meantime, because they're only selling for what they think to be is a massive profit or a financial incentive that is better than the one that's staying. Woodward is the weak man, he's the weak link, he is the problem, and that's where the protest should be aimed.
Yeah, it's, and look, he says he's on the way out. He says he'll consult even if the hunt for the new manager goes beyond the time he's supposed to leave the club, which is good of him, decent of him to stay involved. We're totally out of time, Graham, but Barca against Benfica tonight. Xavi started with a win. Every single match at the moment is a cup final in terms of trying to get out of that group because they started so badly. Can he do it? Can they dig themselves out of that hole?
Yeah, it's a proper cup final because if they win, they're through. And that's a 60 million win and the confidence. They've got injuries that are even worse than they were last weekend. They can do it. I think there's slight odds against winning against Benfica, but they've got extraordinary young footballers. I think De Jong is going to score tonight. I think the Barcelona have a chance. They need to draw to keep it alive for the last game, which is a walk in the park somewhere down in Munich against Bayern. So let's hope at least it's alive so that we can do this again just before match day six.
And Villarreal, there's a good chance they actually beat Man United tonight, right?
The bookies don't agree with you, and the reason for that is that Paco Alcacer is very likely out. Gerard Moreno is out. There are injuries left, right and centre across the Villarreal squad. Unai Emery is having the oddest of seasons, whereby if it wasn't for a couple of decent wins, they'd be down touching the relegation zone. They're good enough to beat Manchester United. They definitely are. I have no idea what impact Michael Carrick will have on United, so I don't want to call the result of the game. But the bookies say that Villarreal are distinctly second favourites at home at the Madrigal against even this wobbly Manchester United. And I guess nobody would be up for shock to Villarreal. Rally, they're difficult to beat, and some Portuguese guy pops up in the 98th minute to score a winner. Let's see.
Well, that's why we watch, because we don't know the results. Graham, great to have you with us. Thanks a million. Cheers. Graham Hunter giving us some pretty interesting thoughts there on who the next United manager will be. For Pochettino to provoke the fight with Leonardo, all he's got to do is say some stuff at the press conference. The players disgust me. They're defending set pieces like that. We don't deserve to be in this league if they defend set pieces like that.
Yeah, he needs some fireworks to be launched from the stands desperately.
That'll get it done, right? It turns out that's all you need. Here's what's on OTB Sports Radio for you a little bit later on today. OTB Gold is Wexford 56 celebrating their All-Ireland victory in 1956 with Ned Wheeler and Art Foley. The Dadcast at 3. Mount Rushmore, South Dublin at 4. OTB Gold is Joe Meets Ruby Walsh at 6. And then the show is live tonight from 7.
OTB AM.
With Gillette. Proud supporters of Movember. Gentlemen, let's move.